Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of the podcast. So I was going to do this one last night, and I decided to check into it a little bit more, because it's something that I've never done, and something that is important, and I think that I find extremely interesting, and hope that you will too. One of the, it's actually the subject of a blind on Thursday and Friday, the two-parter. And there's so much more to it than just Thursday and Friday. I could literally make blinds out of what I was given for a week, if not longer. But it doesn't really lend itself to being a blind. So what I'm going to do is I am just going to read it as it was sent to me, and I think that the Thursday and Friday reveals will probably still be on reveal day in January, but you guys will get it now, way ahead of time. And it's possible that in January I might not reveal it. Maybe I'll save it for some Black Friday in the future, but you guys are going to get it now, just because I can't figure out how to make everything blind and keep the story intact. So I thought I would just read it. And I'm not going to say who the the person is. You know, it is a first-person account. And it is their first-person account. So the person that, the people that they're talking about, that might not be their recollection. But this is her recollection. And I'm going to read it as they sent it. No light editing or anything like that like I did on the site. And then later today, I'll have a second, much lighter episode than this, because this is fairly disturbing. I will tell you that right now. So, trigger warning, I guess. But to me, it is representative of kind of what was going on in Hollywood in the very early 80s, especially the late 70s. But this is early 80s that this took place. And definitely, you know, what Hollywood was kind of going through at the time. Okay. I am coming forward to let you know that I lived with the founder / creator of Kids Incorporated, Michael Hill. And I was living with him while I was 16 years old at the time. I can confirm that the producer was drugging me and a rapist. He had raped one of my friends and slept with four girls I knew, all underaged, in 1984 through 1986. In fact, I lived with him for that 2 years. I met him when he lived next to the beach in Marina Del Rey. He lured my teenage friends and I in with food and beer, later hard drugs like cocaine. He groomed us all and built up our trust over time. Then when I was alone with him and too wasted to defend myself, he forced himself on me. He had previously done the same to my 16-year-old friend and denied, saying she was into it. She was the daughter of an Oscar-winning screenplay writer, and before she moved away, she tried to drown herself by locking herself in the bathroom, drinking a fifth of vodka in a full bathtub until she was unconscious. I saved her life by breaking in before she slipped under the water. She was already unconscious. I was broken after that, and I just stayed with Michael, believing his lies that he would help me with an acting career and a successful future. While I was his housekeeper, chef, and party favor, he was finishing up on his Federated Group commercials with his pals, Shadow Stevens being the head of the production team, and the comedic character Fred Rated. Although I never saw Shadow involved with underage girls, some of his workmates were definitely after my teenage friends. Eventually, the Federated Group, who was funding the commercials, was bought out by Circuit City, and the Fred Rated commercials folded. Not long after, Shadow closed down Shadow Vision on Sunset, and Michael started talking about his new brilliant plan, a kid's show. He spent long hours on the set there, often working late. I know because I was waiting for him to come home. By this time, we had moved from Marina Del Rey to Studio City, and we lived in a 5-bedroom home on top of a hill near Laurel Canyon. That house was super creepy, and I became very sick and depressed there. Anyways, I had no idea who his associates were, or what the plan was with them. lost the place where I was going. Anyways, I had no idea who his associates were or what the plan was with them. He kept his work very private from me, but he said certain things, and he knew the show was going to be a hit even in its infancy stages. I would have really been sick if I knew that he was involved in molesting children while on the set of Kids, Inc. I could tell you more about his mindsets and habits during the time, if it's of any interest, but I'm really reaching out because you're the only one I know of who would talk about this kind of thing. I mean, with how his home life was set up with me and my friends at his disposal, one after the next, I guess the question is, you know, how could he not be involved? And then they continue. Last I heard from Michael's best pal, Chuck, he's still into young girls and has advanced his career quite a bit. I'm not sure if he's still at his current employer, but I heard a couple years ago that he was director of programming at a network. In a position to make or break the careers of many young actresses at this point, I'm pretty sure he's up to his old manipulation tactics. When I was with him, he was reading a book about mind control, and he was really into it. He got me plastered drunk pretty much every night, and I would eventually black out and or pass out, after which he would have sex with me. A couple of times I woke up from my sleep with him standing by my bedside, naked, reciting things to me which he wanted me to repeat back to him. I woke up in the middle of a conversation with him where I was saying, "I will never leave you. I love you more than anything in this world." And he was questioning me, "Tell me again, how much do you love me?" When I opened my eyes and my vision cleared, I could see that he was very sexually excited. There's a couple more guys in the picture that were closely involved with Michael who have also advanced their careers. There was one guy named David who was in the process of buying a magazine company. He has an obsession with playing Captain Jack Sparrow, and he told me that he likes to visit children's hospitals in character. Hearing that made me uncomfortable. The other person involved with Michael, an underage sex seeker, a movie producer who produced and directed a 70s movie with questionable age actresses and content. Then you have, let's see, this Dave, did you mention Dave? Dave guy before. And Dave molested me at 16 and one of my friends also. And she names the woman's name, but I'll just name her first name, maybe. I'll just use an initial L. L lived below Shadow Vision in a small apartment. When I asked Michael why my pal L was now living under their office space, he said that she was with Dave and he gave her a job there in trade for rent. When I asked what kind of job, Michael said a blowjob and laughed his ass off. After that, we never heard from Elle again. She just disappeared, but there was a rumor that she ended up a prostitute in Las Vegas. Dave broke my heart after sleeping with me a few times. He abandoned me and I had already fallen for him, so I was terribly depressed. And Michael started acting super nice to me, offering me to clean his home and trade for a place to stay. His friend Chuck would come to visit, and one night Chuck was very intent on convincing me that he was just like Dave because they were best friends and they were so much alike that I belonged with him instead and he'd be a better boyfriend for me. I was able to fend him off, but as I got drunker, Chuck insisted on having his way with me. Also, I couldn't even sleep next to him afterwards. The same night, my 15-year-old friend, and we're just going to use this initial again, and we'll call her S, who's the daughter of the Oscar-winning writer, went to lay down after both of us getting super drunk. She came out early in the morning crying that Michael had raped her. She took off, and when I confronted Michael, he denied completely, saying that she was all over it. He threatened that I'd have to stay elsewhere if I brought it up again. Later, when Sarah came back to visit me, we talked more, and she said, "I don't care if you still stay here as long as he takes care of you," because she knew I needed a place. That was the day she tried to drown herself in Michael's bathtub while I was at work, and I found her just in time. I saved her life. Chuck disappeared for a few weeks after that. Then Michael made his move on me, dragging me forcefully into his room one night while I was too wasted to defend myself. I asked him, "What do you think? You can just rape me?" He laughed and said, "Yeah, call the cops. They won't believe you, and I'll have them throw you out just so you'll end up in jail." I was drunk, but I'll never forget him grasping my wrist tightly and literally dragging me to his bed. He wasn't tall, but he was thick and stout. I felt I had no choice. Next morning, I felt horrible, and I cried. I remember thinking this must be how S felt. The longer I lived with Michael, the more I began to despise him. No matter how much he provided, home, food, booze, drugs, promises of me and all my friends to get acting work someday, it was not enough to put up with his sick, perverted mentality. During the time I lived with him, I found out that he had already slept with a 15-year-old friend who I used to invite over. We'll call her C. I didn't realize that all three of those men were using me to lure new underage girls into their triangle. Chuck slept with C as well as another 16-year-old K, who is still in the industry today. I became a terrible alcoholic by the time I turned 18. I moved out after Michael got me pregnant and I miscarried. It was very hard on me. Michael refused to acknowledge the pregnancy, though he had unprotected sex with me every night and morning. I became very depressed and began self-harming. Basically, when he realized I wouldn't give up sex to him anymore, he wanted to throw me out on the street, and he did. I dropped contact with Michael, but stayed in contact with Chuck. I got back in touch with Michael after about 17 years. I went to broadcasting classes. I was a teacher's aide for a while. I don't want to say where. Michael had always told me that he'd help me advance my career back when I lived with him. He mind-controlled me to believe I could never make it without him and that my whole future depended on him. Though 17 years went by, I still believed that the only way I could be successful in life was to go back to Michael and serve him somehow. I certainly wanted nothing to do with having sex with him, but I thought I would gain some respect for having spent so much time at school. Michael was the one who told me to go to school and learn the trade, which I did. I learned everything so I'd have the best possible chance to get hired. When I got back in touch with Michael, he invited me over to his home in Burbank. I told him how I trained in every aspect of film and broadcast and needed a break to get my career started. He showed me around his nice home, nice pool, told me all about the nice parties he has, and showed me his nice wardrobe like a show-off. He offered me no assistance with my career, even after all this time and all the training I went through following his advice. In fact, he discouraged me, saying it's really hard to break into the industry, and I can't have you working with me. My girlfriend would freak out. Then I felt very strange, kind of really sick and uncomfortable. So I was getting ready to leave while he was searching for a letter I wrote him when I was 16. He had saved it all these years, and he kept telling me, "You were so in love with me, you can see by the words in your letter to me." When he couldn't find it, he said, "I guess my girlfriend threw it out." Since that time, which appears to be about a decade ago, I've not heard from Michael at all. But apparently, he's still viewing my content on Facebook. Let's see. I think that there's a little bit more. I joined an agency called CAST, Coalition Against Sex Trafficking, and they helped me to make police reports on all three of the men I spoke to you of. Although the statute of limitations will prevent any further police investigation, at least I've come forward. And if any more current incidents involving those three come up, I'm traceable and my testimony can be used in someone else's case. When I was a teenage housekeeper on my own at 15, I met more than a handful of sexual predators, Michael's crew being some of the worst, but there was one more predator, an ER doctor, at the Marina Del Rey Hospital. And the doctor ended up with a segment, fairly frequent segment, on a network show, and he used to live, she's saying where he used to live, so I don't want to say that, but three different streets, so I'm guessing that she really did clean those houses there. When I went to estimate his home, he gave me a couple of glasses of wine and promptly asked if I knew what the white powder substance was that he pulled out of his pocket. I was 15 and wasn't sure. He said it was pharmaceutical cocaine and it's harmless. He wanted to wake me up because the wine was strong and I guess I was acting drunk. He put on Led Zeppelin's House of the Holy LP and proceeded to play it repeatedly while he started massaging me and kissing me. He also then offered me half of a pill, which he also described as harmless and told me it was a quaalude. He pulled it out of a giant jar, like a vitamin jar that read methylcologne on it. Before long, he gave me the other half while he continued pouring wine and giving toots of cocaine to me to keep me awake. Next thing I knew, we were on the floor, him still massaging, and I can't get up. And I got really scared because my hands locked up. I could not close my fist or bend my fingers. I was becoming paralyzed. I told him my concern, and he said, "It's okay, it happens sometimes." And he carried me off to his room where he repeatedly raped me all night. Next day, I couldn't walk. He wanted to give me a shot of some sort to help me heal quicker, but I refused. He told me just to stay there and I could live in his home and have his office as my room, so I stayed as I was a runaway. After he starved me for a couple of weeks and he was always at work around the clock, I ended up eating the last of his grandmother's quiche, which upon discovery threw him into a rage I've never seen. He screamed at me to move out immediately, and I begged for a couple more days, which he agreed to. His sister lived next door on a joint property, and she says the street again, and we had an arrangement that I watch her place for her while she went out of town. During that last couple days, I forgot about the arrangement, and I was so depressed and hopeless that I tried to kill myself with a big bottle of pills. I couldn't find the methaqualone, but I found a big jar of something in the bathroom. I ate two handfuls, put some music on a cassette tape in my Walkman, and cranked it up while I started slipping away. Suddenly, the sister started knocking. Today, she was leaving. I was to meet her beforehand to get the key. The room was spinning, but she kept knocking and then came in. I pretended I was asleep, so she tried to wake me. Then she called this doctor and asked him what to do. I had no choice but to get up and try to convince her that I was fine, which I did, but I had real trouble walking her to the door. Also, when she walked out, she noticed when I slammed my whole hand in the door and quickly reopened to pull it out. I couldn't even feel anything. She asked if I was okay, and I said yes. I went to lay back down and passed out. I woke up at 8 p.m. on the hour, so sick and dizzy I couldn't even crawl straight to the toilet. I was crawling to the wall, missing the doorway. The room was spinning so bad, but I found the toilet in time to vomit, which was a big accomplishment because I was determined not to make a mess when I checked out. I will never forget waking up with shag carpet in my mouth, breathing face down, as the toilet rug had become my pillow. I looked at the clock, which was readable. It said 9 p.m. again on the hour. I barfed profusely again and passed out, waking up every hour on the hour all night long to vomit until I lost consciousness again. Somewhere in the middle of it all, I woke up freezing cold and the room not spinning as bad. I can't remember what hour, maybe 4 a.m. I had been throwing up every hour for probably 8 hours by then, so that's my guess. After 8 hours at the foot of Bruce's toilet, glad I had recently cleaned it beforehand, I was finally able to get up and crawl back to the sofa where I passed out again, but continued waking on the hour to throw up and be able to crawl back and forth to the sofa. I survived the night. I was unkillable. Now what? All I knew is I had to get away from this doctor. I went on the streets, suffered with no safe place to sleep or food, but I had my life still, and he couldn't hurt me anymore, or could he? About a year or so later, I discovered that many of my teenage friends had also met this doctor. He made moves on all of them, including C, who confirmed to me that this doctor was successful at date raping our friend L. Like me, she would allow them to pour the drinks up, but she really couldn't handle her booze at all. Once about 5 or 6 of us teenagers realized what a sick predator that this doctor was, we decided to play a trick on him and show up at his doorstep to call him out as a pervert. He was home and happy to see us all, quickly inviting us in, but our plan to confront him was foiled when a couple girls started eating the Quaaludes he was dishing out and drinking the wine he poured. I was pocketing the pills so I could trade them for food or money to my older friends to help my survival between housekeeping jobs. 3 of the girls went with the doctor into his office where I OD'd, and they closed the door, staying in there a long time. We had already been doing cocaine and lewds and wine, so I got a sick feeling that he was shooting them up with cocaine, as I had found a vial of liquid cocaine and his used syringes in the trash back when I cleaned his house. I left the party disgusted that my underage friends were possibly partaking in his delights and that he was able to use his drugs again to control. I wanted no part of it. I walked home to an apartment where I had a room. I had recently turned 16, and I was drunk from the wine, so I fell asleep quickly. Next thing I knew, a stranger had broken into the apartment and was climbing in bed with me and grabbing me. I screamed, but no one was home yet from the doctor's place. The stranger tried to rape me, but somehow I got up in my bed on my knees, and though it was very dark at the moment, I could see the outline of this man's head from the light outside of my window, so I punched as hard as I could and hit him square in the nose, and he cried out in pain. I jumped up, switched on the light, and guess who was holding his bloody nose in his hand? The doctor. Even I was shocked. I screamed at him to leave, and I ran to the door, but he ran out first, so I locked it again and waited for my friends' roommates to come home. Next morning, guess who was knocking on my door again, pounding? Yep, you guessed it, the doctor. He had the nerve to yell at me on my front doorstep. He said, "I helped you when you had nowhere to go." His nose was swollen looking. I was scared that he may have had a syringe or gun in his pocket because he was very angry. I had the front door on a chain lock, and he demanded to come in, trying to push his way in, but the chain had stopped him. I threatened that if he didn't leave, I'd call the cops and tell them everything. He did leave. A year or so later, I was stuck going to a hospital after a terrible burn I got. By misfortune chance, the doctor was working the ER that day. He treated me like crap. He waited and waited, taking forever to look at the burn. I had to ask the nurse twice to please hurry him as I was in excruciating pain and a giant blister was developing. He refused to bring me anything to cool the burn, and he refused any pain meds. I had to ask the nurse to give me wet paper towels to soothe the burn, as I waited endlessly for the doctor to actually do his job. As I left, I couldn't help but shout, "Where's all your Quaaludes now, when I really need one?" I would only see him one last time as C and I were walking down this alley behind his beachfront house. His car was parked in front of his garage. C was telling me how he kicked her out after she tried to get her friend L to leave with her because it was getting late, and the three of them had lots of wine and pills that night. She told me that the doctor had molested L in his jacuzzi at his new house. I was disgusted, and C, being humorous, saw a newspaper and some dog poop on the ground. We were right next to his car, and she took the newspaper, grabbed the poop, and quickly smeared it on his brand new car. Unfortunately, you know, we should have reported him, but we were afraid of his money and his power over people with his drugs and his position as a prominent ER doctor. My helpers at CAST assisted me in making a police report on him. They found out by a Google search that he is an actor now. After so many years of guilt for keeping quiet, I finally told the authorities, and at the same time I reported the others. It was a great relief to have been able to say something to someone, but my hands are still tied on how I can disclose this information to the public in a way that doesn't set me up for big trouble yet can reach the right people who may have been through something similar. You know, I might, this one that I just read you about the doctor, I might make that into a blind. I think that that's a pretty powerful story. So, anyway, something much lighter later today, but I wanted to share that with you guys, and it was a really powerful story, and it's really moved me this week, and I just wanted to figure out a way to kind of get it out there. All right, so I will talk to you guys later this afternoon.